Good morning. And thank you very much for joining me in bringing the 2010-11 academic year to its official opening at the School of Divinity. Although I know the students have had enough homework that it feels like it's been open for a while. I have been on the job officially for a little over a month, and Tom Frank and I are grateful for the welcome that we have received from everyone at Wake Forest University, and especially at the School of Divinity. I look forward to getting to know all of you better and working with you during this academic year. We have many exciting challenges to face together and many opportunities to ensure that the School of Divinity excels at its mission of educating visionary leaders for the church and world. I am deeply appreciative of the support of everyone in this room, and it is fair to say that I will rely on that support as we move forward. The Genesis 32 story of Jacob wrestling with God is one of the most well-known stories in the Bible. It is the source of countless theological metaphors of human-divine interaction, and is the source for an endless litanies of ways of naming our relationship with God. In preparing for this address, I Googled wrestling with God and wrestling with angels. I didn't go too deep into what I found, I must tell you, because I thought it would get dangerous down there near the end, but my Google search yielded 579,000 results. I think it is fair to say that the story of wrestling with God seems to have popular imagination, listen for the pun, pinned. The wrestlers in the group got it. And I suppose that makes sense. The United States is an inherently competitive culture with founding national metaphors based on the power of the individual to conquer obstacles to success against all odds. The power of the individual to prevail carries over into our national fascination, obsession, with sports, and here too, Jacob's story slides very easily into common cultural metaphors and assumptions. We love the story of a struggle in which human initiative and determination prevails. This Jacob story appears to mirror back to us some of our most common assumptions about ourselves and our place in the world, about what it means to be human. And for most of my life, I will admit to having been in the thrall of this metaphor, nodding happily as our wrestling match with God is held up as a theological good, accepting that I can't get anything from God without a struggle, that everything worth receiving is worth struggling for, and so on and so on. A very prominent preacher titled a recent article about preaching, "The Weekly Wrestling Match." And when I first read the article, I thought, how clever. But on further reflection, I thought, enough. I am tired of our life with God, personal and communal, being described primarily in agonistic terms, as a battle, a competition that we have to win in order to get anything from God. So I have returned, and I'm taking you with me, to the banks of the river Jabbok to see if there is another, a better way. The Jacob whom we meet in this story is not a happy man. He is alone because he has sent his family and entire household away to safety in anticipation of a dreaded reunion with his brother Esau. Jacob and Esau have not seen each other for 20 years, and the last words spoken by Esau in the story were, "I will kill my brother Jacob." So as Jacob stands alone at the river, Jacob is afraid, Jacob is defensive, Jacob is, as always, working the odds. Jacob is out to prove that by God he can stand up for himself. when he meets the unknown man in the dark, alone, already primed for a fight, Jacob does what Jacob does best. He gives his all for his own survival. Never mind if maybe a marathon wrestling match was not the reason the stranger appeared to Jacob. Jacob will not be taken advantage of by anyone, by God. One of the wonders of this story is that it begins this way, as a recognition story. Jacob does not know the identity of the man with whom he wrestles. And the storyteller spins the tale so that we join Jacob in this lack of recognition. Even though, given the importance of this episode in subsequent storytelling about Jacob, there is not a reader of Genesis then or now who does not know who it is that Jacob wrestles. The two wrestlers are evenly matched, and no wonder. Jacob wrestles as if he were fighting for his life, driven by his fear of Esau. The man strikes Jacob on the hip, but that wound does not stop Jacob or lead him to loosen his grasp on the man he takes to be his opponent. And this exegetical detail is to me the first clue that maybe we have been reading the wrestling metaphor wrong. This encounter between Jacob and the man is only a battle because Jacob makes it a battle. Only a struggle because Jacob won't let go. Listen carefully to the beginning of the wrestling match again. Jacob was left alone, and the man wrestled with him until daybreak. Who started the wrestling match? Jacob or the man? 99%, 99.9, I think, of interpreters assume the man started the match. Here's a typical description. During the night and in a surprise attack, God wrestles Jacob to the ground. But the story is marvelously and intentionally ambiguous about who made the first move. The duration of the match, not its beginnings, is described. It fits the popular mythology of individual struggle against all odds to have the man be the attacker. But given what we know about Jacob, it is equally credible that Jacob, nervous about his upcoming encounter with his murderous brother, jumped at a stranger approaching him in the dark. By wounding him, the man tries to get Jacob's attention, tries to bring the match to a conclusion by distracting Jacob with an injury. But Jacob will have none of it. Jacob is so absorbed in the struggle, so intent on not being beaten, that he has not noticed that the sky is growing lighter and that daybreak is approaching. Jacob is so intent on being the victor, so intent on not being pinned by his opponent, that he has not noticed who his opponent is. Daybreak matters because biblical tradition holds that no human can look on the face of God and survive. So in Jacob's intense drive not to let go of the man who has come to him in the dark, when he was vulnerable and alone, Jacob now risks two things. He risks his life by seeing God face to face, and perhaps more important, he risks the moment of recognition altogether. Jacob risks winning the wrestling match and losing the chance to be knowingly in the presence of God. The injury did not do the trick, so the man says directly to Jacob, "Let me go." for the day is breaking. You are so busy wrestling to win, Jacob, that you do not see that time is running short. But even in the face of those words, Jacob is so set on the struggle, so set on victory or avoiding defeat, that Jacob continues to set the terms of the encounter. "I will not let you go unless you bless me," he insists. Instead of a new blessing, though, the man gives Jacob a new name, a name that acknowledges what this story illustrates, that Jacob is a man who is defined by struggle, and that Jacob is a man who prevails in the struggle. This new name does not change who Jacob is. Jacob continues to be called Jacob for the rest of his life. But it does provide a shorthand for the central plot of Jacob's life. Jacob strives with God and humans, and Jacob prevails. And to show that this new name is indeed the right name, even receiving this name does not get Jacob to cease from the struggle. Instead, Jacob shows that he still wants, needs to win on his own terms. "Please tell me your name." I can only imagine God's frustration at this moment. Jacob has a singular opportunity. He stands alone, face to face with the divine, and all he wants is to win. He wants the spoils of the struggle. He wants God's name. But God has had enough. God has played on Jacob's terms long enough, all night, in fact. And so God ignores Jacob's agonistic question, "Why is it that you ask my name?" and instead blesses Jacob. Then, and only then, does Jacob let go of his drive to win and recognize that he is in the presence of divine grace and divine love. "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved." According to everything Jacob thinks he knows about his God, Jacob should be dead. But he is not. Finally, Jacob no longer speaks in terms of winning and losing, but simply of being alive in the presence of God. The sun rises, day breaks, and Jacob walks away, limping. He was wounded because of his own need to fight to his last breath, instead of allowing himself to notice that he spent the evening in the presence of God. Jacob wrestled with God, all right, all night. But his insistence on wrestling was a hindrance, not an aid, to being in the presence of God. His desire to win and not be vanquished became an obstacle to the offer of love and grace that was before him all the time. One of the most famous artistic representations of this story is the fresco by Eugène Delacroix at Saint-Sulpice in Paris, a church now much more famous for its role in the Da Vinci Code than for Delacroix's painting. But what are you going to do? Prior to Delacroix, this story had been of limited interest to painters. But after Delacroix, and directly under the influence of his work, the emerging French symbolist movement saw in the Jacob story and artistic renditions of it the ambiguities of their own pursuit of art and of the artistic vocation. It took Delacroix 12 years to complete the Saint-Sulpice wall paintings, and the Jacob painting is an unquestioned masterpiece. The wall painting is huge, so that the figures of Jacob and the wrestling partner are more than life size, and they tower over the viewer. In Delacroix's painting, Jacob and his wrestling partner are evenly matched physically. They're almost the same body type. And the main trait that distinguishes the man from Jacob is the man's telltale angel wings. That and the fact that in Delacroix's painting, the angel does not break a sweat, and all the struggle is in Jacob's body and Jacob's battle. The angel's head is up, and Jacob's head is down, buried in the angel's chest. Jacob can see nothing, looks at nothing. All the force and torque of his body are fully engaged in resisting the angel. There is little question when you look at Delacroix's painting that if Jacob would relent, if Jacob would raise his head and look at the angel, he would recognize that he is already in the embrace of the divine instead of locked in mortal combat. We live in an intensely agonistic age. Everything is a battle. And our public and private rhetoric, in politics, in higher education, in religious life, seems to know of only one option, whether or not you are an opponent. And once that verdict is cast, there is no turning back. The wrestling match has begun, and by God, my side is not going to let down. As a nation, we are engaged in an actual war where men and women from all sides lay their lives on the line every day. But we are so consumed by bellicose rhetoric that we can no longer see the cost and cannot think or reason clearly, because having an opponent is all. We prove we are right by announcing that someone else is wrong. And we all pay the price for this, whichever side you think you are on. Unlike in Delacroix's painting, I am not sure there are any angels left in America, because we have all become Jacob, determined to win. My hope for us all this morning, and especially for the School of Divinity and its students and alumni, is that we can lead our churches and our communities in a way that breaks the cycle of struggle for the sake of struggle. Struggle for the sake of not letting someone else win. We must learn to lead in ways that open us to be surprised by the possibilities for newness and hope that are already around us, waiting to be set loose in the world. Religious life and religious leadership, like the culture in which they are embedded, share in the practice of defining who we are by who we are against. Yes, there is struggle. Yes, there are decisions to be made and sides to be chosen. But take care, lest we decide too early in the encounter the names and identities of our opponents. As theological educators, as present and future leaders, whose vocations call us to work and pray for the inbreaking of God's reign of justice into the world, we need to be able to recognize when the strike to our hip socket is not the next stage in the battle, but an attempt to open our eyes to see more than our preconceptions. Jacob is neither leader nor model in this story, because his head was buried so deep in the struggle, so determined not to lose, that he did not even understand the grace that was already before him. Jacob was not able to be surprised by anything because he was so sure of what the stakes were when the man appeared to him at the Jabbok. This is what Jacob almost missed, but what God did not allow Jacob to miss. Jacob was in the full presence of God, arm in arm with the possibilities of God, and all he could think about was winning and losing. But there was no way Jacob could have lost that wrestling match. How can you lose when you are already in the presence of the love and grace of God? Charles Wesley, the great 18th century poet and hymn writer, understood this about the Jacob story, understood it better than perhaps anyone before or since. In his poem, Wrestling Jacob, Wesley moves inside the story of Jacob's wrestling and reveals the name of Jacob's opponent. The morning breaks, the shadows flee. Pure universal love thou art. To me, to all, thy mercies move. Thy nature and thy name is love. Wesley's poem is written from the perspective not of an agonistic Jacob, but of a Jacob who recognized the gift before him. In the poem's final stanza, Wesley names the presence of God that is revealed in the Jacob story, a presence that is masked if and when we focus on the struggle. Lame as I am, I take the prey, hell, earth, and sin with ease o'ercome. I leap for joy, pursue my way, and as a bounding heart fly home through all eternity to prove thy nature and thy name is love. There is no losing and there is no winning because it is not a contest. God is not our opponent. We are not God's prey. There is only the love and grace of God, always available to us, always ready to bless us. This love and this grace meets us when we are alone by the river, at night, entrenched in our fear and our aggression. And it holds us tight enough to free us to greet a new day. Thanks be to God.